All right, let's get going. We're going to do something that's going to help some of the guys in the room who feel like parts of this might be a little too touchy-feely to kind of bring it around in a slightly different way that's going to broaden things out. So we've been talking a lot about the importance of biblical fellowship. And one of the things we said about it is that there's different forms of biblical fellowship, from big corporate worship all the way down to something that's way more intimate. All of them are valuable. All of them are important. It's not that we're saying that it has to be just this big, intimate, deep and close thing. There's a range to it. But one of the things that we've also been saying is that biblical fellowship of all forms is really important. It's part of what leads us to move through the sanctification process. The more we're connected, the better it goes. And so oftentimes what we find is that when people get into community, when people learn how to relate authentically, they can put us therapists out of business. And frankly, I would be thrilled for that. That would be awesome if the church took its place and really did a phenomenal job at that. And then those of us who wanted to remain being therapists would probably do things that are very specific to our trainings. And so that would still work out great. Now, this semester, we're really looking more at the how, the practical. How are we going to get there? How do we really help our fellow brothers and sisters out? And we're doing this by slowly increasing the level of depth that we're sharing in this semester. And so we're going to get some practice. We're going to do some things that are going to help develop some basic skills, very basic skills that we've all got, that if we sharpen, it's actually going to do a ton for us, and it's going to do a ton for those around us. So, let me start first by asking a question. Let's just see what responses we get from you guys. What makes biblical fellowship different from a normal or a secular relationship? So what makes biblical fellowship different than a normal or secular relationship? Who's got some thoughts? Yep. So one thing that definitely makes a biblical fellowship different is that it's a Christ-centered relationship. So we probably will talk more about Christ in that relationship than we would in a secular relationship. What else? Yes, sir. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so with a Christ-centered relationship, it can really bring down the walls. You have something so strongly in common, which is the gospel. And so as we've said a few times in a few different ways, those of us who believe the gospel, we actually have more in common with each other than we do with some members of our own family. And so that can bring the walls down. And that there's sometimes barriers in a secular one. Yes?
I don't know if this is actually the case, but it should be that biblical fellowship more diverse, like socioeconomically,
yep,
racially, ethnically, where in the secular it should be more monolithic, or birds of a feather flock together, kind of thing. I don't know if that
actually. That is actually a really good one, and I never really thought of it, so that's perfect. That's going to go on the slides next time we do this. So I'm just telling you right now, that's getting borrowed. The thing which is wonderful about getting the gospel is it's the great leveler. We're all equals. And whatever demographics we think are superior or inferior, there's no such thing when it comes to the gospel. We are all brothers and sisters in Christ. We're all firstborn heirs. We all have the same promises delivered to us that God gave every single believer. And so it just levels things out. And so that's a great one. I think I saw another hand somewhere. Yes. Yeah.
Also, you're surrendering yourself to a higher being, so therefore, you feel a lot more humble in that regard.
Awesome. So, two things with that. It has a great vision, right? So, one of the things, I'm in a YouVersion Bible study with a bunch of guys, and we're going through the book of Revelation. So, you can only imagine how much we're struggling as we're going through it, and I keep having to run back to all the sermons we did here on Revelation just to figure everything out. But one of the things that I love is that at the end of the day, God's going to win, right? And at the end of the day, the battle's already won for all intents and purposes. We're just going to see it through. So we're a part of this thing that's going to be huge. And then because it really isn't us, it's him that's doing it, it also brings some humility. And so typically biblical fellowship can have a great deal more humility in it. Any other thoughts? This is great. Yes?
It's meant to be edifying.
Yeah. So one of the things that biblical fellowship does is it's grounded in helping us understand our justification so that we move further and further in sanctification. And so what we should see in biblical fellowship is iron sharpening iron. We should see this way in which we're all fighting for each other's good, and in a sense to draw closer and closer to Christ. Ultimately, it's really getting that Christ absolutely loves us with everything he has and is. And the more we get that, the more we now want to love him with everything we are and have. And so it comes back. Yes? Yeah. Yeah. We are going to steal that one as well. So let me say that again, which is great. So one of the things that's very true about biblical fellowship is it's not me-focused. It's really more Christ-focused, and it's more about what am I giving to someone else. And in the process of us giving each other the best of what we got, what winds up happening is both people are lifted up. And so it's a great way to kind of get other-centered. So Tim Keller had this book, The Freedom of Self-Forgetfulness. And when you said that, it was like, that's actually some of what's inside that book, which is really, really powerful and great. So thank you. Yes?
What really amazes me is that through here and through ESL, we meet people from all different nations. And some of those, they go back to the particular nation. But yes, you can say, one of these days, we'll meet again.
Yeah. That's it. So one of the things that's really cool about biblical fellowship and connecting to other believers is even if we're from different parts of the world, and this is a really transient city in Atlanta, we know that we will see each other again. There's going to be a glorious moment where we will grab dinner together in heaven somewhere. And so we'll have a really good time. And so we'll enjoy that. Yes, sir. Yeah, one of the things that's so true about biblical fellowship is we're actually moving a conversation to what would be the most pleasurable thing we can experience, which is God himself. And so in the process of doing that, there's not a lot of room for coarse gesturing or sexual things or whatever. It's really, we got something better than that. We can really talk about Christ and the gospel and the amazing thing that he did for us, which we are going to spend all eternity unpacking, right? So it's not like we're ever going to get to the bottom of it. And we're just going to get newer, 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 newer heights as we're going along in heaven, never fully arriving. Yes?
So it doesn't mean the church scandal relating to sex is an isolated incident?
No. The unfortunate thing the good thing about biblical fellowship is that it does deal with real sinful people with a real sinful nature. And so typically what we find is when we're known and when we're connected to, we actually start to move towards Christ more, so that kind of drops the chances of those big scandals that usually happen not like a one-off, it's usually building to that point. And by the time it's usually discovered, unfortunately, it's usually pretty rampant. And so I've worked with over 200 and something pastors, and by the time they kind of, usually most of them, there was something sexual that was going on. Sometimes it's in the media, sometimes it's not in the media. And I could tell you that most of them, it was like a decade or two before it was discovered. Usually a long trajectory. So hopefully if we got people in our lives, that actually helps us stop and prevent all of that, which is awesome. Awesome. Any other thoughts? Yep.
It feels a lot more, I guess, reliant on each other and kind of comforting in a way that if I'm here and I'm mourning or I'm in a very hard time, that person comes alongside of me, whereas in a secular relationship, often it's, well, I'm here, and you're here, I'm going to stay here.
Yeah, you do you, I'll do me, and I'm going to stay over here in that process. So one of the things that's fantastic about biblical fellowship is we're commanded to mourn with those who mourn and rejoice with those who rejoice, so we're really going to get in. And on top of that, we're still going to have great boundaries. We're not going to lose ourselves in the process, as we'll talk about when we go through this further. But the idea is to have this relationship where we no longer feel alone, where we actually feel known and met. And what I've got to tell you is a lot of times when clients show up to a therapist's office, a lot of times the biggest issue that they're not talking about is how alone they feel in whatever it is that they're struggling with. And that's usually, once you resolve the aloneness, oftentimes it's crazy how fast resolution can come to something that has even been long-standing, just because now they finally feel connected to. Somebody gets them. Somebody's in it with them. They're no longer alone. And now there's possibilities, and tremendous possibilities for growth. Awesome. This was great. Let's keep going. So biblical fellowship is rooted in our relationship with Christ. We need to be close and deep enough with other believers to be able to exhort each other in Christ. So we're not saying that everybody in the room is going to become best friends with each other, or besties, or BFFs, or whatever today's acronym is for it. That's not necessarily going to happen. But we do have to have a real taste for each other, a real sense for one another, because then we can really encourage, get in there, help somebody not be alone. If you're not close or deep with other believers, they can't see enough about you to know how to spur you on in love and good deeds. So oftentimes in the Christian faith, we are going to go through some trials. We're going to go through some harder times. It's going to challenge us at times. We're going to feel stretched. And so what we need is other people to kind of come in with us, especially when we're at that point where we feel like we're overstretched, to be able to help us through and encourage us to keep going. Similarly, if we don't get to know more about others, we will be blind to ways we can spur others on to love and good deeds. So what is going to be really surprising to some of us in the room is we might be surprised by how helpful we can be to somebody else. So sometimes what we've noticed when we talk about topics like this is some people say, I don't even know where to start to help somebody, so I'm almost afraid to say anything, so I don't say anything, and I try to remove myself. And the reality is we could do a heck of a lot that could be really, really helpful for people just by listening and empathizing, if nothing else. Without biblical fellowship, we miss out on sanctification and spiritual challenge, encouragement and help, and witness to unbelievers in the world. So one of the things that happens when you start forming deeper relationships in the body of Christ is that people really notice it, and especially non-Christians really notice there's something different about the dynamic between these two people. But the reality is us Christians also notice, because we're kind of hungry for it, those of us that don't have it at that level. And so there's a draw, and that's one of the things we want to see. So let's give an example, because today we're going to talk about different ways that we can help people. And so let's say we have a friend named Sylvia. If you guys want to change it to a guy's name, let's call what's the male equivalent of Sylvia? Is there a male equivalent to Sylvia? Sylvester, thank you. So it's either Sylvia / Sylvester, and we're not going to get that pronoun thing going in this class with the person who taught about CRT in the back of the room, right? We're not going to do that here. But anyway, your friend Sylvia or Sylvester is going through a hard time lately. As you grow in fellowship, she shares more about her difficulties, and you want to help her. So what do? Listen. What else? You ask about the difficulties. What else? You what? You ask about why it's hard. What else do we do? What else is an option as to how to help? Yeah. Oh, yeah. So sometimes in our excitement to say, oh, look, I get it, we then take over the conversation for the next 20 minutes, and Sylvia's left there like, any moment we want to reverse it, we can kind of reverse it back. Yep. You could say we pray for her. We could pray with her on her own. Yep. What else can we do? Yep. I'm going to clear off some time, get that quality time going so that she feels unobstructed. What else can we do? Yep. Yeah.
You know, you can listen, but I sometimes need him to say, this is what I need to work on.
oh my goodness, there's so many sessions that I'm in where I'm like literally saying, Lord, anytime you want to show up, it's the right time right now. Like right now, you know, anytime. And so, yeah, we definitely want to ask the Holy Spirit to empower us, to give us words, help the connection. What else can we do? What else is another option? Yes? Yeah, you can ask point blank, how can I help you? Let's jump right off that one. That's actually the big winner. So let me just say a little bit more about this. As those of you probably know, I am, yeah. And so let's round of applause. So as those of you know, I'm certified in a personality assessment called Myers-Briggs, and there's 16 different personality types. They're all different. Your personality is actually formed at birth. It can have some elasticity, but it's formed at birth. One of the ways that we know that is if you're in a baby ward with newborns, like a baby ward just filled with newborns, and literally if somebody makes a loud noise, the babies who turn towards the noise will grow up to become extroverts. The babies that either stay still or look away, if you follow them, they'll turn out to be introverts. And so it's a freaky thing, but it works from baby time. We knew these guys were introverted and extroverted just by some little things like that. Now, one of the things that is true about personality types is different personality types respond to help differently. Some of us really want to be connected to emotionally. Some of us just want the answer. If you got the answer, just give it to me. Some of us just want this. Some of us want that. We often have to ask the question, how do we help? Because unfortunately, there's all these different types of help that can happen and more, right? So some of it might be advice giving. And throughout this series, we've talked about holding back on advice until you've connected, until they really feel like you're hearing them. And you won't always want to time the advice. But still, at the end of the day, somebody might say, I just need to know what you think. What do you think I should do? Just tell me. And I've got plenty of clients that have done that. I've done that myself, even though I'm a feeler type that typically wants the empathy. Sharing personal stories, but not 20 minutes worth, so that you're taking over the conversations, is really helpful. Sometimes, like, a mentor will often say, this is how I handled it. And so that's a role we could take with them. Empathy. Empathy is so powerful. Right now, in our country, there's two traits that are being searched for incoming CEOs of large companies. The trait up until this year that was number one is humility. For the first time in, I think, 8 or 9 years, the one trait that's slightly above it right now is an empathetic leader, just slightly above it. And empathy is your ability to feel what somebody else feels. And typically, when you can get there, the person feels really met, connected to, and feels almost like released. And usually what I find in sessions is they actually, it seems like they get worse, like they descend into a darker place, but that's actually what they need in order to spring out and actually get the healing that they need. Next one, sympathy. I am so sorry this has happened. Some people just want somebody else to validate the experience. This is hard. It is awful. And sympathy can often do that. Service, what can I do to help? Some people want practical help. So I'll never forget one time my wife, when we had the twins, you know, her life had gone from being this, like, the best school teacher of the school to, like, the most intelligent conversation she has is with a four-month-old, right? And that was, like, a huge transition. And I'll never forget, because of sleep schedules and all of that, she was going to lose her mind. And here I'm thinking, I'm going to empathize with her. I'm going to do all this. And she was like, no, I just need to sleep on Saturday. That's all I need, and I'll be good. I'm like, oh, okay, got it, you know. And so then we just started that up, and that was great. Physical presence. Those of us like me who have physical touch as their love language, a hug conveys way more to us than it typically does to other people. It is a way in which we feel loved. We feel like we're together. Praying together in the moment is huge. Somebody knowing that we're bringing this to God, and it's not just me bringing it to God, somebody else is bringing it to God with me, that could be phenomenal. Any of these and more are really valid. And it's not that one is necessarily bad. Usually it's a question of timing. It's when do you use it that's the issue. And so oftentimes that's what we're kind of looking for. By the way, I'm going to ask Megan to always put this up there. Is there anything else that you can think of that people want other than what's on this list? Yes.
I think the biggest thing that I have found in my dealing with prisoners,
yeah,
I've had over 300 different prisoners that I have corresponded with.
Wow.
And forgiveness.
Yeah.
At the heart of so many of them.
Oh, my goodness, yeah.
Because I deal with people that have, they are murderers.
Yeah.
There are people that are, you know, all different kinds of, you know, how do I forgive?
Yeah.
It's easy to say, yeah, Christ, forgive me. But it's hard for me to show forgiveness.
Oh, yeah. And sometimes it's hard for us to forgive ourselves. Yeah. So actually, one of the things to jump off that, all healing goes through forgiveness. So it doesn't matter why somebody's showing up in a counseling office. Usually before that really changes and before it's really transformed, they would have forgiven something pretty big along the way. And so all healing goes through forgiveness. I can't think of a single time in 30 years that it doesn't. And if we haven't gotten to something forgiven, and let's say the client wants to end, I'm usually pretty nervous because I'm usually thinking I'm going to get a call in 2 to 6 months. Hey, it's back. Or, hey, I'm no longer doing X, but now I'm doing Y, and Y feels just as bad as X. And I'm usually like, oh, I hate that. Let's just get to the thing to forgive. So that's absolutely right. Yes?
Listening.
I can't believe we didn't have that there. Yes. It's actually the number one thing we've talked about this whole series. So, yes, listening is the type of help that needs to be up there, and it will be up there as soon as you get the recording. Yep.
I think at that point, like under services, here's what I'm going to help you to help. Sometimes, like, is it practical? Sometimes, if you're drowning in pain, and someone asks, what can I do to help? There's just nothing that you can say that you do need a meal for or something like that. Just say,
yeah, so sometimes taking a little bit of control might help, especially when somebody's overwhelmed with pain and they don't even know where to start. And so if we say, hey, I'm going to go for the grocery store, I'm going to pick you up a week's worth of groceries. We good with that? Is there anything you don't eat? Like, just very practical stuff could be really huge. Absolutely. Yes, sir?
One of the things not to do.
Yes.
You know, when people come to you for help, don't start by throwing Bible verses
at them. Oh, my goodness, yes.
That really turns people off.
Oh, yes. So I can tell you, I think I've mentioned this once before, some of the angriest sessions from people that I've experienced is when a loved one dies and they're at a funeral and a bunch of people throw a Bible verse at them while they were saying condolences. And typically what the person always says is something to the effect, it's like, I'm not allowed to feel. You know, and usually once they feel that, they kind of feel kind of stifled. So it's not that they're genuine believers, they get over that, eventually they hear the Bible verses, it really connects to them, it's just the timing. Bible verses are fantastic at the right time. Exactly. Anything else? Great list. Yes, sir?
I think you need to be careful with personal stories. If I were to tell somebody I had a real bad headache, they say, oh yeah, I had that, they pulled a tumor out, and I was...
Get that imagination going. Yeah. Oh, yeah, you have a headache. I got a migraine. I love it. That is so true. One-upmanship is definitely not on the top 10 list of things to do when somebody's struggling. So definitely not there. So you're right. Anything else before we continue? Great. Let's keep going. All right, so now we're going to get into our famous groups of three. What I'd love for you guys to do is to share what you believe is your natural preference for giving and receiving help. And if you can share an example of what helps look like to you for the others in your group, that would be awesome. And if you could also list out how do you know when to share help, how does receiving help in your preference make you feel, what happens when you receive the help in your preference? What happens to you? So once again, no married couples, no twins, no family together. As I walk towards my kids. All righty, let's keep going. Let's keep going. Yes? Please.
So my first thought is identify the person you would like to help. And then because you identify this person, and then you approach this person, that's how I you know, process my help to other people.
Yeah, so that could be a great way too. If you're noticing that there's a bunch of people that you could possibly help, is try to identify who you're going to focus on, because unfortunately all of us are limited and we can't do it all. And so that would be great. And especially if you sense their style might be something similar to your style, it makes it a little easier. But the good news is throughout this series, you're going to get tools to hit any style. And so we could broaden it out and do a ton of things. That's awesome. All right, one thing that we want to kind of stress for a second is, have you ever said to someone, or has someone ever said to you, or have you ever heard someone say something like, when somebody else is trying to help them, somebody say, why can't you just listen? Or, yeah, that kind of thing, it just doesn't work for me. Nah, it's not my thing. Or, well, the reason I've been doing what I'm doing is because... dot, dot, dot. Ever had that experience? I should raise both my hands. I've done it. I felt it. I think I'm guilty. Right? So oftentimes, what's that a sign of? If somebody says any of those three things, what's it a sign of? They don't feel understood. So now we're in Job chapter 4. Job has just finished speaking. The man has poured out his heart, described exactly where his heart is, served it up on a platter. And the first things his friends do after doing a brilliant job being quiet, they actually started to speak and blew it. First thing they do is start smacking him upside the head. You know, you must have sinned. Let's talk about the sin. Let's correct you, brother. You know, let's get in there, right? So they start doing all sorts of things. And then by chapter 6, Job is calling them worthless friends. Scary. These guys gave up more than a week of life to just sit with the man in silence for 7 days and seven nights. The incredible level of empathy that must have been going on for 7 days and seven nights, blown because the friends start getting into some sort of mode of, let's tell Job what's wrong with his life and let's get him together. It just doesn't work that way, right? And so oftentimes, whenever somebody says this, what we know is that literally they don't believe we're hearing them. So real fast, what's one way you could show that you're hearing somebody?
Mirroring, paraphrasing back to them with a, do I understand
that? That's it. So if ever somebody gives you that, slow down, stop, start repeating back what you heard them say, and then just ask, am I off? Anything missing? What am I missing? You know, any phrase like that usually starts bringing the connection back. And usually what they hear is, oh, you really do want to get me. So now let me give you more. Because we really want to be gotten, especially if we're going to pour our hearts out to somebody. We feel pretty vulnerable when we do. And so typically we're going to get right back in there. So one of the things we always want to make sure is that we're giving help in a way that helps others. And so the golden rule of help, where is she? She has moved. Where is she gone? Oh my goodness, Sandy's right here. Sorry. How would you like me to help you right now? When in doubt, this is a great question to ask. Literally, if you even say to somebody, man, you know, they poured out their heart, I hate what you're going through. How can I help you right now? What do you really want from me? And sometimes we have to go a little further if they're not really getting it there. Sometimes we have to get a little bit more specific. So I wouldn't start with question two. I would lead with question one. And then question two is something along the lines of, tell me what you really need right now. Is it just for me to connect to you, for me to hear you? Or are we like really talking about giving some sort of advice? So everybody's probably seen the video with the nail on the woman's head, and the guy's not supposed to say, just remove the nail, and everybody's like dying throughout the 3-minute video, like, you just have to pull the nail off, and it's oh. And yet the woman, what she's really wanting is just to be connected to. It's not about the nail, as the video says. It's really about the connection. And oftentimes, believe it or not, most of us who kind of can be too quick to give advice, we're often giving advice for the wrong thing. We're often giving advice for the wrong thing. Because even though the person's saying words that it sounds like you're giving advice for the right thing, if there isn't connection first, it's definitely not the right thing. Because even if you said the exact right thing they needed to hear, pull the nail out of your head, it's simple. Pull. If they're not there, it's not going to happen. It's not going to work. Third thing. Sometimes if you know that the person is a hugger or whatever, sometimes saying that is great. So when I gave my testimonial, I thought it was like outrageous that somebody picked up that my love language was physical touch. And I couldn't believe she did. She actually asked my wife if she could give me a hug, which I thought that was like amazing. I thought that was great. So sometimes that's it. And we can always say, you know, you could say no. And sometimes it's practical advice, practical help, practical getting in there. I know you're overwhelmed. Let me take over some. Just something practical can relieve a ton. So always start with number one. 2 through 4 usually fall from number one. And so we're just trying to discern it. Make sense? I hope. All right. So the key thing that we always want to remember about biblical fellowship is that it's definitely not your responsibility to fix somebody. So let me stress something. If any of you are working with a therapist or a coach, it's actually not our job to fix you. And people are usually shocked when I say that. Wait a minute, I'm paying you all this money and you're not going to fix me? Wait, what's going on? Wait, what? And it's because usually what we're doing is something different. We're usually empowering our clients to come up with really great solutions for themselves. And if we start to feel too much pressure to try to fix somebody, say the wrong thing, usually we get tongue-tied and we don't do a really good job. But when we're more like in the space of, I can't wait to see what God does, and we're kind of involved in the process, getting in there, using curiosity, asking questions, it's incredible what can happen. And sometimes a question that you didn't think was the best question on the earth is the one that tends to unlock everything. And it's because you're not so anxious about doing the right thing. You're more trying to just connect. So one of the things that you want to do is if you find yourself being somebody who just constantly is giving advice, or you're feeling like, I don't even know what advice to give someone, and you're starting to feel that pressure, that's usually a sign that you're not really trusting God to work through whatever is happening at that moment. The pressure's on you. If you were a therapist, just think, the average therapist sees 25 to 30 clients a week. Imagine if you felt that 25 to 30 times a week. You now know why therapists burn out by the 7th year. You now know. And so the idea is we've got to flip back to trust God and what he's going to do. Now, we're not going to take 6 minutes each. We're only going to take 3 minutes each. But what we're going to do is we're going to just, in the same groups, just share how you prefer to help and a challenge you're going through these days. And the challenge can be light, like, you know, I'm kind of busy these days, or it could be deeper. Man, I just feel distant from God. I'm spiritually dry. It doesn't matter what level it is. I would just say use discernment with the level of trust you have with the people that you're sitting with, and use discernment, obviously, because it's mixed sexes in each table. So be wise as to what you're going to share. Just to share according to your comfort level, let's just do this real fast, 3 minutes each, how you prefer to receive help and a challenge you're going through these days. Now, the other two are going to do is you guys are going to listen. You're going to practice sharing help in the way the speaker prefers to receive help. And if you have some a little bit of extra time in that 3 minutes, the person does it in 2, ask for feedback. Did you feel supported by what I just did? What would have helped you feel more supported? Use this as a great time to practice. It's as safe and as a layup as you can possibly get. 3 minutes is all you got, right? So it's got to be a layup. And then be gracious with the feedback back. Go for it. All righty. All righty. Those of you that need to get to Jerry so that I can keep my time righteousness going, if you guys could take off to Jerry. Make sure I don't get in trouble. Feel free to take off. Everybody else, any questions? Any questions at all? Some of those discussions you had were fantastic. Any questions? Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. 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 Oh, yeah. 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 Oh, yeah. Yeah. One of the hardest things about the COVID time, just tying it into what you just said, is how many people were feeling helpless. So in particular, during the time in particular when family members were dying, and nobody was allowed to visit them. You know, what I've experienced was three clients who were going through that. One was losing his mother. And out of, like, this one client, I might cry if I'm not careful because I'm remembering the sessions and it was really intense. He was, one second. He wasn't really loved as a child. And he was really abused by a lot of different people. And he felt like the only person in his life that really loved him was his mother. And now she's dying, and he can't be there. And he's a type A CEO, charging, you know, like always, you know, the guy with the action and the answer and this. And he pulled every single connection he could pull to try to get into that nursing home, and they wouldn't let him. And then she died, right? And for him, watching him go through helplessness, he actually said to me, I don't know what's worse, losing my mother or feeling like I might have been able to do something and she would still be here. Because he's used to coming up with the answer. That's what he's paid to do in his role, right? So he's always the answer guy. So one of the things that we want to talk about when it comes to helplessness is that many times in the Christian life, we will go through times when we feel helpless. And it's designed on purpose. Because what I think God sometimes is trying to get us to do is to remember who he is. Because especially if we're type A personality types who are very used to, like, you know, getting in there, solving it, doing it, you know, kind of deal, we have to come to our limits so that we can see how much we need him. And sometimes what God has masterful at doing is creating scenarios to make sure we get there so that we actually say, oh, wait a minute, I need to depend on you somehow, and I don't know how to depend on you right now because I'm not able to feel like I'm doing something. How do I even be still? how do I trust you? And then usually what winds up happening, and this is why biblical fellowship is so important, is we actually need people to connect to us right there. And they don't have to fix us, they just have to be with us. And it's crazy watching what happened. So I'll never forget when he came back and his mom died and we had that next session. I don't know how many minutes we spent crying in that session. But it was, he literally said that's what he needed. Because he didn't feel like he could do that with his wife. He didn't feel like he could do that with his kids. He didn't feel like he could do that with his coworkers. He's supposed to be the strong one, right? That's his role. You know, but finally this 60-something-year-old man broke down. And it was like a cry like when my boys were small kind of cry. It was deep, guttural, and all of that. So awesome point. The idea, once again, is especially when we feel helpless. Especially when we feel helpless, we need to be connected to. And biblical fellowship is ideal because it's two people connecting, especially with the foundation of Christ under it. And then eventually the conversation can move towards something that at least helps you, even if you can't do something about the action. Awesome. What else we got? Great question. Yes, sir.
I found out that I'm not the only one that has a certain problem with things, and by able to hear that helps me in my fellowship.
Yeah.
I got something in common.
Oh, yeah. So oftentimes, one of the beautiful things about fellowship is when we get deep and somebody starts sharing, somebody else says, oh, me too, I'm just like you. And it's like relieving that we're not alone. And so one of the things about biblical fellowship is when people let down their guards, we usually see we have far more in common than we thought, including similar problems. Awesome point. Any other comments? I know some people are heading for the choir.
Over here.
Yes, sir.
Circumatic discipline. Because we went through the exercise and I think it went well. We responded as we had been requested to. And we're sort of patting ourselves on the back that we did a good job and just start talking about how we had similar things in our lives. You know, and that wasn't what we had been asked for earlier. We had been talking amongst ourselves. We need to not do that.
There are times to do it. There are times, especially when it's shorter, like much shorter than 20 minutes or whatever it was that we were joking about earlier. So definitely sometimes some therapists will never self-disclose. They'll never share a personal story, and there's reasons for that. Some therapists choose to share a personal story, but they usually, if they're smart, do it within boundaries. So they don't usually share anything that's really raw raw at all right now for them. Usually the purpose of sharing a personal story is to foster connection, to help the client not feel alone, and to help the client feel hope. Because if somebody else has been through it and they're further down the road than they are, they often say, hey, maybe I can get there too. And that often starts to shift their mindset towards being solution-oriented versus being a victim. So some amount of storytelling back is important just for us to connect. But we don't want to take over the conversation. Really brief. And so typically when a therapist will do this, it's no longer than 30 seconds to 2 minutes, typically. And usually it's short, succinct, enough that the person knows you've been through something similar. And then the connection's fostered. Great point. Great, great point. Anyone else? All right, next week we're going to talk more about practical skills. We're going to dive in deeper. Megan and I are actually working on it. That's why we didn't put up what was going to come in next, because I now know what we're going to do next, but I'm going to surprise you next time.